Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We didn't really get to what transpired over the weekend in Chicago for Memorial Day weekend yesterday because, of course, we were spending a lot of time focused on Uvalde and the ongoing fallout from that massacre, understandably. But we do want to get to the massacre that occurs every weekend in Chicago, particularly when summer is upon us. And so, again, the grisly stats. So what was it?
49 shot, 9 dead.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I think we need to start doing, because I don't think anybody really does this.
What do you want to do?
Is getting some profile on the victims, the people that are killed, even if they're not necessarily upstanding members of society.
No honor roll students, you mean?
Yeah, even if they weren't about to turn their life around. I don't know. I just think when we just do the 49 and 9 and the stats every week or weekend, it just further desensitizes us, dehumanizes the victims as just a number. And so, every once in a while you see a news outlet do that, the profiles of all the kids under 18 killed,
right,
pictures of them on a front page or something like that. But on a rolling basis, to tell the stories, maybe how...
I can call the ME. Cook County ME, because she's amazed at how many people are getting shot and killed, and nobody, no one, is focusing on this.
How would the medical examiner know the story of the person who was killed?
Well, I'm saying that she's surprised at how many people under the age of 18 are getting slaughtered in the streets of Chicago, and that nobody cares.
So I want to hear from family members, people who know them. I want to hear who they were. What happened? How were they in a position, maybe through some fault of their own, where they were one of the small group of people that's responsible for the preponderance of the mayhem in Chicago, the kill or be killed cohort, if you will?
We had a 16-year-old that was killed right by our Ashland and Irving, and I fought like heck to get any information. Like, why would a 16-year-old be involved? And, you know, there was 80-plus shell casings, Dan, on the ground that police found. And he was a 16-year-old Asian kid, high school dropout, gangbanger. So, wow. I mean, I think that's a lot of what we're going to find.
It may be. That may be. But so mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, coach, whoever.
He sat there for 3 days.
So what's the story? How did we get to that point where that 16-year-old is a high school dropout and a gangbanger? Maybe there'd be something instructive about that. I don't know. And maybe nobody wants to talk, even family members or friends or those that were involved in the lives of these murder victims. I don't know. But it may be worth trying. Maybe worth sending up a flare and see if anybody responds. So maybe we'll try to do that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Because otherwise, we're left to tell you stories like this. Louis Molina Jr., a twice-convicted gun offender, escaped from electronic monitoring last September, then remained on the loose until mid-April. 5 days before authorities caught up with him, Molina and a four-time felon named Hector Rivera opened fire on a carload of people outside a liquor store. Two were shot. Molina is the 21st person just this year accused of killing or shooting or trying to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting trial for a felony. The alleged crimes just this year involve 49 victims, 11 of whom died. This is sort of like when we talk about the border. if you cannot expel from this country people who are here illegally and committed violent crimes, then there's nothing else to talk about with respect to immigration reform. And so I would say the same thing about domestic policing in Chicago. If you cannot keep those awaiting trial on felony charges from committing additional felonies while they're awaiting trial, then we have nothing else to talk about when it comes to policing and all of the and the law enforcement, you know, writ large, the criminal justice system writ large, from Lightfoot to Brown to Fox to Evans, the whole thing. There's nothing else to talk about. If you can't accomplish that task, why should we have any confidence you can accomplish any task? We shouldn't. Or we could tell you this story. Chicago man accused this week of shooting a friend in September of 21 after losing money to the victim in a card game. Right, they get intense. Yeah. I've been in some of those card games. He had a felony case pending at him at the time. He skipped bail the next month. Okay. Tracked him down last week. He becomes the 72nd person last year accused of killing or shooting or trying to shoot or kill someone while awaiting trial for a felony. So we're up to 6 dozen last year. We're already at almost 2 dozen this year. And, I mean, the mayhem that represents, the wounded and the dead that represents. And also, you know, we want to talk about crawl into the mind of the Uvalde school shooter and other mass murderers. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'd like to crawl in the mind of the Melrose Park man who was charged Sunday with setting fire to a homeless guy.
Oh, the walking man.
Yeah. By the way, the walking man
I love the walking man.
He's being stylized a bit. The walking man is a notorious pickpocket.
I know, because he pickpockets you and then he walks away. It's the walking man. I talked to him for 12 years whenever I'd run into him, like, how you doing?
Uh-huh. How many times did you leave with your purse?
Anyway, but you don't deserve to be set on fire.
Nobody does, obviously.
Oh, my God. When walking man stopped walking, they set him on fire. That monster set him on fire.
A 75-year-old man who's sleeping on a loading dock on Lower Wabash, and somebody thinks, I want to set him on fire?
He's not doing well, by the way. I don't expect him to make it.
Do you want to crawl into the mind of that individual? I mean, because, of course, Chicago police have arrested that individual 13 times between the years 2014 and 2018 for minor crimes like retail theft and trespassing on the CTA, simple battery, Lakeview, uptown, downtown areas. Not been arrested since 2018, maybe because he moved to the suburbs. And the maybe is true. Records show he's been charged with multiple suburban burglaries since then. So, you know, it's also one of these stories where, oh, you don't want to prosecute these nonviolent offenses, no matter how repetitive they become with these quote-unquote nonviolent offenders. Well, then sometimes they graduate. Maybe you don't really understand who you have in custody. Maybe you have somebody in custody who thinks it's a decent idea to light somebody on fire.
God. He burns more than 70% of his body.
So, I don't know. I don't know. Which stories do you want to talk about? Which stories do you want to hear? Which stories do you think are productive to try to address, shed light, commiserate?
Well, Superintendent Brown yesterday, of course, blamed the guns, not the person holding the gun.
Guns. It's the guns. It's past time to get some significant, real gun reform in this country.
Well, okay, what? Yeah, the floor is yours, Superintendent Brown. What do you want?
Yesterday, they touted that on Monday they confiscated 75 weapons, illegal weapons, off the streets of Chicago.
I saw 250 over the weekend. Chicago police, 250
alone,
guns.
But Monday alone, that's what they were.
Yeah. And so?
And so what's happening? Yeah. Governor Pritzker passed a law against ghost guns, so you can't print one up on a 3D printer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's going to help. When he signed that legislation, I'm like, there we go. That's the answer.
He finally got around to seeing Malkovich and In the Line of Fire. Wonderful. Yeah. I didn't hear what the proposal was.
Well, they have 100 new recruits that graduated yesterday.
The proposal.
It's the same thing. I've been listening to this for...
What's the proposal?
They're going to keep continuing to confiscate illegal weapons. That's going to help.
Well, but that's not what he said. It's long past time for gun reform. So what's the reform? What's the proposed reform?
We reminded him that there was a gun ban in Chicago for 25 years, and we are the murder capital, what, twice that time? Nobody listens. Gangbangers don't follow the laws that are on the books.
What about this, Superintendent Brown? 15 hijackings so far in Lakeview this year. Your neck of the woods.
Oh, yeah. We know.
That's up from 6 the same time last year. So it's more this year than the last 3 years combined, actually. Citywide, 621 carjackings as of May 20th. That's up from 599 last year. By comparison, in 2020, there were 300. In 2019, there were 183. So we've doubled in the last 2 years the number of carjackings. We've increased them almost fivefold since 2019.
Yeah, but Dan, you don't understand. Now, once you get carjacked or hijacked, however you want to call it, the city doesn't pay. You don't have to pay to get your car back now, because they normally use your car for another carjacking, for, you know, something else, and then they put it in the pound. And you had to pay $200. Lloyd Lightfoot, they waived that fee now.
That
so
is
now
a great deal.
Now you're not victimized twice. It's another legislation that was signed. I'm like, yes, there you go. Helping the victim now, not victimizing the victim again.
Yeah, that is.
It's all coming together, Dan, because she just said it.
That's a great deal that you don't have to pay to get your car back after you've been carjacked.
Yeah, and had a gun waved in your head or pointed to your head or gotten the snot kicked out of you.
That seems like it's getting to the root of the problem.
Yeah, it is.
Ziff in Hyde Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Ziff.
Good morning, guys. You all are fired up this morning. Dan and Avery, you will fall out of your chair when I tell you the things that it took to save 200 young people from June to October last year. But you got to keep them contained on the court or on the baseball court. I had to get juices. The school gave me lunches. I bought beverages, sometimes some sweets. They like sweets. But we had one kid to come with a gun. And so they worked it out with the state's attorney because he didn't have background, but he had a gun. So he said, man, I'm not coming up to this court without a gun. And then when we played ball, a couple of the guys that had guns on the side. But here's what I want to tell you about. But juices, you would believe, they had nutrition. Save these 200 kids from getting involved. We only had one incident. But here's the thing. When I wash cars, I wipe cars down at Buddy Bear's after when you pull out, Dan, and Amy, with your car. And I look in the guy's laps, and you see Glocks and 38 just sitting right there. So some nutritional things might help, Dan. Thank you, guys.
All right, thanks for the call.
My neighbor puts her German Shepherd in the passenger seat so that nobody – that's her way of protecting herself.
Okay.
I think it's great. I'm going to put Bunky in.
I don't know if Bunky is going to be quite as intimidating, but, yeah, okay. Randy Sandwich.
You know how when you go to New York and you see the national debt clock and how it's spinning faster than a slot machine, it even tells you the portion for each person in the United States of what they actually owe in all that national debt. I think it's high time that we took and put a clock similar to that on 294, on the Reagan, Dan Ryan, that shows all the shootings that happened. It shows all the murders that happen, and then periodically put a person's face up there that got killed so you can see it firsthand, the number and the person who died, so it becomes more realistic rather than just part of the weather report each and every morning.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Thanks for the call, Randy. David and McCook.
Hey, good morning, guys. Have you ever had the misfortune of being like at Cicero and Madison at 4 a.m.?
Yes, I have.
I drive a tractor trailer, and occasionally I have to do a delivery down in those areas. There are more people out milling around at 4 a.m. than at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Drug dealers, gangbangers, general scumbags, they obviously don't work. So you're out at 4 o'clock in the morning, bad things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they're working. And yeah, you're right.
David.
It's 4 in the morning. It's all day long. All night long.
It's not where like that. Is there like a pizza joint there, like Uncle Remus or something like that? Isn't there a pizza joint, Madison Cicero?
Where are we ordering from there today?
I think I'm recalling from portions of my misspent youth when I could stay up that late and I didn't have to be at work to do a radio show at 5 in the morning.
Or as normal people say, before we had children, but, you know.
Well, that too.
That too.
before
you got serious about your golf game.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. All right.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the jury in the Michael Sussman trial acquitted Sussman of lying to the FBI. Sussman is the Hillary Clinton campaign attorney who brought the phony baloney Steele dossier to the FBI, opened these Russian collusion investigations, said he wasn't working for the Clinton campaign when he was working for the Clinton campaign, which is
a lie, right?
The basis of the indictment for lying to the FBI. But the jury nonetheless acquitted him. Here's what Michael Sussman had to say upon his acquittal.
First, I told the truth to the FBI, and the jury clearly recognized that with their unanimous verdict today. I'm grateful to the members of the jury for their careful and thoughtful service. Despite being falsely accused, I'm relieved that justice ultimately prevailed in my case. As you can imagine, this has been a difficult year for my family and me. But right now, we are just grateful for the love and support of so many during this ordeal. And I'm looking forward to getting back to the work that I love.
I love you, Michael Sussman.
Please come back. I can't live another day without you. So basically, he said, you know, he wasn't trying to sway an election. It was a civic duty that he had to tell the FBI, you know, what was going on about a document that was created and made up out of thin air.
And he couldn't disclose that he was working for the Hillary Clinton campaign. He had to pretend like he wasn't in order to do his civic duty. Sure. Uh-huh. Okay.
See you there.
So there's a couple of ways to look at this, and this is being batted around. One is this is a very disappointing outcome for John Durham. It's a very disappointing outcome for the special prosecutor's work. It's more evidence of a rigged system. A lot of talk yesterday about the composition of the jury in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Did he get a fair trial?
The jury included one federal government employee who told the judge they donated to Democrats in 2016. Another government employee told the judge they strongly dislike Trump. Both of those jurors told the judge they could be impartial throughout the trial, though. The jury also included a teacher, an illustrator, a mechanic, and more. One juror had a child who was on the same high school sports team as Sussman's child.
How did they let that happen? Mm. Are you kidding me?
Now, wow. That was the jury. So, you know, was this, you'd look at this, you'd say, well, this was, I mean, but again, he was acquitted, so it was unanimous. You look at this and you say, well, it's rigged. It was D.C. The jury pool needed some chlorine, and that's what happened here.
312-642-56, excuse me, 00, turnkey.pro answer line. Our text line's open, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
But there's another way to look at it, too. Ari Fleischer was on with our friend Britt Baer in Special Report yesterday to react to the verdict. Ari Fleischer, former spokesman for W. And he had this to say, including the jury, including about Hillary Clinton, and including this last piece we want to develop a bit.
Well, several points. One, you said the jury was hardly ideal. Well, yes, the jury was hardly ideal. It had three Hillary Clinton donors on it, one Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez donor on it, and one juror's daughter plays on a sports team with Mr. Sussman's daughter. So, yeah, that jury in District of Columbia was hardly ideal. But look, I'm loath to comment on jury trials unless I'm a juror and I heard every fact about it. So with jury rules, you have to accept it. But there are three things that go on beyond this trial. One, Hillary Clinton got away with it. We all know now if you're going to commit dirty tricks in politics, you hire a law firm, you lie to the FEC about what the money you're spending on the law firm, you let the law firm hire an opposition research firm that hires a spy, a British spy, to spread false information about your opponent. That's how you get away with it. The other factors are the FBI was happily duped in this matter.
Happily duped. That's the key phrase here. And this is a point that Andy McCarthy makes in his piece in the New York Post about it as well, our friend Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, that Durham lost because he treated the FBI as a dupe rather than a collaborator. And we've talked about this in discussions about this Russian collusion matter and all the players, the D.C. press corps, the FBI, the intelligence community. Victims duped, scammed by the Clinton campaign, or co-conspirators, collaborators? And I think there's something to that. I think, and Holman Jenkins has the same take in his piece in the journal, Durham jury convicts the FBI. The Durham prosecution did a better job of convicting the victim than they did the culprit. The victim, quote unquote, was the FBI, but the FBI wasn't a victim. The FBI was happily duped, as Ari Fleischer said, which is that they were in on it. That's the real story.
Too, don't you?
Yes. That's the real story here. Now, Sussman still lied to the FBI. He still committed a crime. But you can understand why a jury would say, how is he lying to the James Baker at the FBI when they're all working off the same
script,
game plan? There's one thing that mitigates that contention. And I think it was the jury foreperson who said, the FBI has better things to do.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that tells me that's somebody who's politicized. And, this isn't important, or it's not important because I don't like the target. I don't like the target because I liked what the target was doing in trying to take out Trump. So that smacks of maybe some political bias at play here. But I do think there is this issue that you hear the verdict and you say, how could this happen? And you're sitting on this jury and you're listening to the prosecution present its case. And maybe you've been following it in some pertinent part, regardless of whatever you said in voir dire. And you say, well, wait a second. These guys were in on it. So why should I convict Sussman and not anybody at the FBI if this was a hustle that they were all partners in? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text.
And what does this mean for the 3-year-old Durham investigation?
Well, there's still another prosecution to be had. You still have Igor Danchenko, who was the source for the Steele dossier. He is awaiting trial. Okay. That will happen in Virginia, Arlington, I believe.
Why can't we get this out of the D.C. area? Just so that we have a fair jury.
Well, and Danchenko, may shed more light on the machinations of the fraud, of the conspiracy to defraud the American public that was afoot. Just like in this trial, the Sussman trial, you had Robbie Mook, Clinton campaign manager, who made the disclosure that the big girl knew about it. She green-lighted it. Now, we, of course, suspected that.
Right.
It's logical to believe that from the beginning, but it's always nice to have the campaign manager point the finger at the candidate and say, yeah, she knew about it, and she gave us the green light. So Danchenko may shed more light on the interactions between all these players, including maybe on the FBI, on the intel side of the ledger. Those other entities and individuals at the upper reaches of those entities that were happily duped. Kip in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, first off, with the problem in Chicago with all the violence, we really do need open carry throughout the United States. Because look at the justice system. The police are doing their jobs. There is no justice for the Americans, the true Americans out here, that are really scratching their head after the Sussman thing. What a rigged system and a rigged world and a rigged country that we are in. Now they are going after our guns. You look at the legislation up in Canada. Yeah, I mean, look what they're trying to do here, what they're going to do in Canada, and saying it's an international thing. The WHO going against the Americans. We are in such a corrupt world now, Dan and Amy, that we have to defend ourselves before actually bad things happen. The only way to do that is to be armed at all times. And these people, And the FBI, you do not talk to the FBI. Tell them to go pound wood. You guys have a great day and chin up. America will get through this. Peace out.
All right, okay. Thanks.
Chin up, peace out. Got that.
All right. Lee and Hammond.
Hey, guys. Yeah, you know, this jury pool there in D.C., this is just the same like if you had a gangbanger trial in Chicago and you had family members or actual members of, like, El Rukins, MS-13, Latin Kings. I mean, anybody that takes this justice system, to echo the last caller, seriously, you've got to be an idiot. And again, to echo him, the reason we have a Second Amendment is because of tyranny. Like these people are getting ready to foist on people in the Western, actually all Western countries. Like you said, what went on the other day in Canada where they're going after all the guns, they're looking for any excuse to disarm the people. If you look at what's going on now in Ukraine and Russia, the first thing a tyrant does is disarm the citizens. And this is what the Second Amendment's really all about.
Thanks for the call, Lee. It's the old saying, right? We don't have a justice system. We have a legal system. And that is an indictment of our justice system. Well, there's good reason. And we talked yesterday with Kevin Brock, former assistant director of Intel at the FBI. He said, you know, the consequences of the corruption within the upper ranks of the FBI is that you don't trust the FBI on things you want to trust the FBI to do. Like profiling mass murderers, like working with local law enforcement to aid the domestic peacekeeping mission at the state and city level. You know, there are consequences when you destroy your credibility among wide swaths of the populace, which is what the FBI has done and frankly continues to do. Jim in Sheboygan.
Yeah, so a few years ago, Kim Strassel, who's basically covered the Russian hoax and
yep.
the whole affair for years,
mm-hmm.
She had a editorial years ago which lowered my expectations and helped me figure this out. And she said about William Barr, I just hope that for the American people, he'll be able to unravel the conspiracy, unravel what happened for the American people. And that was her, the whole point of her editorial. And I think Durham's doing that.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks for the call, Jim. And there was also calls, maybe it was from Jonathan Turley, George Washington University law professor, but others, renewed calls in the wake of this jury verdict yesterday, the importance of the special counsel's report, whether that comes after the Danchenko trial.
Don't you think it will?
Or
before?
Well, we don't. It's not going to come before, but we don't know if Durham has other lines of inquiry that remain open. So, but the importance of that special counsel's report that sums this all up, regardless of whether there are criminal charges available to go after individuals who were in the decision-making roles for this Russian collusion hoax that was perpetrated on the American people. Mike Hobart, Indiana.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that, you know, who believes in our justice system now? You got people like your ex-governor getting more time than Al Capone, but these people are untouchable. It doesn't matter what they do. And Hunter Biden's untouchable too. So, you know, there's a two-tiered justice system in the U.S. now.
At least two tiers. Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. We'll see what happens with Hunter. That's a good point. I mean, I think maybe one ray of hope.
Yeah.
In terms of restoring faith in the American legal system, make it the justice system again, is if Johnny Depp wins that defamation case against Amber Heard. That's the real trial I'm concerned about.
It's so unchristian. It's so gross to watch. I can't stand it. I want it to be over. And I know they're waiting for the jury's decision, but come on. Why would you bring that up in the public anyway? And also, too, while you were gone.
What month are we on in the Depp Heard trial, by the way?
It feels like it's going on. Does anybody know, Mike? Anybody? 3 months? I don't know. don't know what that was. That was just
it's weeks old. This is a pretty straightforward defamation case, but I understand that everybody in Hollywood needs to testify on one side or the other. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you for taking my call. Listen, we're not like a third world country, banana republic. We're worse, and I mean that literally. We're worse. They admit to it. It's open to all the public. They know what's going on and everything. Here in the United States, they pretend to be all like just and honest and everything. Up in the higher ranks and everything, our government and everything, being so good and being like the you know, like an example to the rest of the world. And look at the kind of things going. And they go and they arrest and everything, like these grandmas and kids running around in the Capitol for taking pictures and everything. Sussman and Clinton's and all these things, everything. They run free and everything to do whatever the hell they want. And the FBI agents and all these people breaking all kinds of laws up and down. And I mean important laws to our justice system. And they get away with it. And then they lock up people because of their political leaning. I mean, we're gut shot, period.
Thanks for the call, Craig. Well, I mean, Sussman was indicted. And he was, you know, tried and judged by a jury of his peers.
And Durham said yesterday that he respects the jury's decision.
Jury of his peers, including, you know, people that his kid played youth sports with. Sure.
Because that's a bond. That's a huge community. You know everyone on your kid's sports teams. You know all of the parents.
Lady Justice is supposed to be blind, but I think these days in our hyper-politicized country, we have her peeking out from underneath the blindfolds from time to time, depending on who the target is.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the clownfish, Leah Thomas, sat down for an interview to unpack, if you will, all that he has endured since he decided to identify as a woman and swim for the University of Pennsylvania women's swim team.
Yeah, he knew that there would be controversy.
I knew there would be scrutiny against me if I competed as a woman. I was prepared for that, but I also don't need anybody's permission to be myself and to do the sport that I love.
So he was on.
Well, actually, you do need somebody's permission to play sports. Actually, you do.
Yeah, and he was on the men's swim team freshman year and sophomore year. Then was not comfortable in his own body, and there was something wrong, Dan.
I didn't feel like I was a boy. I was like, this isn't me. This isn't who I am.
He's got a deep voice for a girl.
Stop. But he's got a new nose ring. Looks very feminine, yes. But talked about, you know, gender dysphoria, felt suicidal, was depressed, and that does come along with it.
I was barely going to classes. I could really barely get out of bed. And I said, I can't live like this anymore. And I want to be able to do things I enjoy.
Even if it might cost me my swimming
career. Yeah, and that's part of what kept me from transitioning for so long is I wasn't sure if I could continue swimming and doing the sport that I loved.
So he thought of an out. You know, I'm going to take a year off. He got on HRT hormonal replacement. And so he had, according to NCAA rules, if you're going to do that, you have to sit out a year.
Wait a second.
What?
NCAA rules. No one can stop him from doing the sport that he loves to do the way he wants to do it. What's with this NCAA rules?
The NCAA rules, this is during the interview, what he told Juju Chang was that he had to be out for a year and it affected his body.
So there are rules.
There are rules. And guess what? Women are weak. That's what I learned.
The mental and emotional changes actually happened very quickly. I was feeling a lot better mentally. I was less depressed, and then I lost muscle mass, and I became a lot weaker and a lot slower in the water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure you did.
Well, how,
a lot slower.
Maybe how much weaker and how much slower?
I don't know. Those times worse.
So the science is pretty clear on this. The strength advantage that men have, particular upper body strength. Women have ranges about 1/3 to 2/3 of the upper body strength that men have, you know, on average. I became weaker. You're a 6'6 dude who is a Division I athlete.
Big hands, long arms.
How much weaker? So we see how much weaker as he's dominating these swimming events as a man competing as a woman.
Well, why did he do it for the medals?
There's a lot of factors that go into a race and how well you do. And the biggest change for me is that I'm happy. And sophomore year, where I had my best times competing with the men, I was miserable. And so having that be lifted is incredibly relieving and allows me to put my all into training, into racing. Trans people don't transition for athletics. We transition to be happy and authentic and our true selves. Transitioning to get an advantage is not something that ever factors into our decisions.
You didn't transition to win more medals.
No.
He transitioned happy. It's all about him. I mean, after watching this whole interview, I just thought that he was selfish, trying to be a victim. And he cares about his feelings and his well-being, and he doesn't care about the future of women's sports. What he's doing right now will change the future of women's sports. And he has a message. 16 players wrote anonymous letters to the Penn State president and others, and some parents did as well. And Juju Chang asked him about this, and here's his message to those people, those haters out there.
You can't go halfway and be like, I support trans women and trans people, but only to a certain point, where if you support trans women as women and they've met all the NCAA requirements, then I don't know if you can really say something like that. Trans women are not a threat to women's sports.
Trans women are not a threat to women's sports. Eddie's not going to stop there. Remember we talked about the Olympics 2024 in Paris? In Paris? Wait, here's his answer.
As competing as my authentic self was just such an amazing experience to have these things that I've been working towards for so long all come together.
Are there Olympics in your future?
It's been a goal of mine to swim at Olympic trials for a very long time, and I would love to see that through.
Yeah, he's not going to stop. Yeah.
Well,
why would he?
He's not interested in the attention or the opportunity to be an Olympic athlete. Was he on track to be an Olympian as a man?
No, he was not. But now that he is. But he said, yeah, and he's not doing this. You know, he still doesn't think, and he said that he doesn't have a competitive advantage because he's taking the hormone blockers.
Well, there's a lot of female swimmers in Division I that competed with him on the same team, University of Penn, as well as against him, that disagree. And one spoke with Matt Walsh for his documentary that releases today, I think, What is a Woman? If you brought up concerns about it, you were deemed transphobic, said this female Penn swimmer who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Of course, on the condition of anonymity. The fact that you have to address these things
anonymously,
so many people believe they need to address these things anonymously. What does that say about the nature of that movement? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. What does it say about any movement, any issue, any topic, where to address it, to disagree with the zeitgeist of the day, you're compelled, you think, to address it anonymously for fear of repercussions. What does it say about that movement? What does it say about proponents of that particular position, regardless of the issue? I'll tell you what the truth is, but I have to do it on a condition of anonymity.
That's a sad aspect of our culture right now.
Mm-hmm. And remember, the proponents of identitarian politics, LGBTQIA+, and as well as the racial identity politics, they are couched, their positions always couched as a blow for tolerance. This is in advance of making the society more inclusive, more enlightened. Seattle Pacific University students protest after the campus administration voted last week to uphold rules that ban the hiring of LGBTQ plus staff from working at the university. Seattle Pacific is a private Christian university. The Board of Trustees voted to retain the university's current employee lifestyle expectations regarding sexual conduct, very much like Wheaton College had. You know, no sex outside of marriage. If you get divorced, you are gone. That happened at Wheaton College. So that's heterosexual. That was a heterosexual professor who was fired. And when he was fired, he said, I knew I would be fired because that's the condition of employment. Students walked out of class to protest in front of the university president's office. The faculty and staff at Seattle Pacific University must, quote, continue to reflect a traditional view of on biblical marriage and sexuality as an expression of long-held church teaching and biblical interpretation. Well, A.J. Larson, who graduated from Seattle Pacific 2 years ago, said, I'm quoting him, and the quote's important, no matter what you believe, getting rid of these policies is the best way to make sure that our campus is an inclusive place for all people to be. Not only in the student body, but in the faculty, staff, and administration. And that's going to make Seattle Pacific University a much better place to be. That's what you're hearing here with Leah Thomas. No matter what you believe, getting rid of these policies is the best way to make sure our campus is inclusive. So in other words, no matter what you believe, unless you believe what the university was founded upon, this is going to make our university more inclusive by removing people who believe in the biblical teaching upon which the university was founded. We're going to make it more inclusive by excluding people who disagree with us. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you understand, that's the entirety of this identitarian political movement. And as David Mamet said in that interview he gave to Adam Carolla a couple of weeks ago, the thing that the left most fears, these new Marxists most fear, is exclusion. So they're going to get to you before common sense wins the day and you allow them to have their views and live their authentic lives as however they want to the point of another person's nose. They don't get to impose their will. You can have your views. Spout whatever you want. Spout communist propaganda. Run around with, the multicolored LGBTQIA plus flag and articulate for that and call for the repeal of the Second Amendment. Articulate whatever you want. But your right to your views stops at the point of my nose. And this is what these movements expressly oppose. But they know they can't be honest about it, so they offer oxymoronic statements like, no matter what you believe, getting rid of these policies. Well, what if I believe in those policies? Well, you can't believe that.
You can't believe it. No.
That's the one thing you can't believe. Whatever it is we're trying to tear down, that's the one thing you can't believe in order that we can be more inclusive by making sure you're not part of this institution, this team, whatever, this company. That's the entirety of this movement. And it will embrace reductio ad absurdum in order to advance the imposition of their will. Everywhere. It is totalitarian in disposition. It is expansionist. You know, we played the couple of clips from Ricky Gervais's most recent stand-up special because he's getting heat because he made some trans jokes. I played that yesterday. We'll play this clip again because you think it's a joke, but wait for it. Here's the real punchline after you hear from Gervais.
Like, a joke is a window to the comedian's true soul. It's just, that's just not the case. I'll take on any view to make the joke funniest. I'll pretend to be right-wing. I'll pretend to be left-wing. I'll pretend to be clever. I'll pretend to be stupid. Whatever makes the joke funnier without prejudice. Okay, full disclosure, in real life, of course I support trans rights. I support all human rights. And trans rights are human rights, you know? Live your best life. Use your preferred pronouns. Be the gender that you feel that you are. But meet me halfway, ladies. Lose the That's all I say. Women. I mean the old-fashioned ones. You know, the old-fashioned women. Oh, God. You know, the ones with wombs. Oh. Those fucking dinosaurs. No, I love the new women. I know the new women. They're great, aren't they? You know, the new ones we've been seeing lately. The ones with beards and they're as good as... They're as good as gold. I love them. No, it's the old-fashioned. And now the old-fashioned, they go, oh, they want to use our toilets. Why shouldn't they use your toilets? For ladies. They are ladies. Look at their pronouns. What about this person isn't a lady? Well, his penis. Her penis, you f***ing bigot. What if he rapes me? What if she rapes you? You f***ing turf.
What if she raped you? This story, the BBC changed the testimony of a rape victim after a debate over the pronouns of her transgender attacker. The woman referred to her alleged rapist as him.
Yeah, because he raped her.
But him identified as a her. So the BBC in reporting changed the pronouns associated with the alleged rapist to she.
So she was raped by a she.
The he was that allegedly committed the rape was identifying as a she. So you think Gervais is joking? No, he's just reading BBC news reports. Because that's where it's actually at.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Dan in Salem, Wisconsin.
Oh, that comedian was funny as hell. Hey, Dan and Amy, you know, I just feel like, you know, there's nothing you can do. Just Clinton gets away with everything. All these Democrats get away with everything. And now this Sossaman guy, whatever, he got away with it. I'm reading the newspaper. It's outdated. I feel like Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah, you know? Thanks. We'll talk to you later, Dan.
Thanks, Dan. I mean, that's something you can do at least at the local school level. Like, I don't know, if your kid goes to Abbott Grade School in Waukegan and the school puts on a drag show without notifying you as a parent.
Did you see those pictures? I sent that over.
We talked about it couple weeks ago. I mean, Not the Bee website had put together a mega thread of all the libs of TikTok. Preschool in Massachusetts hosting a pride event, including drag queen story time and a pride parade. Bar in Texas advertising a drag show for children, including the opportunity for some kids to perform with drag queens on stage. Children and drag queens dancing for adults, with some kids even collecting money on stage at a drag convention this week.
Well, that's just prostitution right there.
Teacher hosting a drag show for students in Pennsylvania. That teacher is now on leave. No parents not notified. Arizona, a teacher arranged a drag show for students. She was later arrested for having sex with a student. Jasper, Indiana, a pride event with a drag queen performance being advertised for all ages, and they're encouraging kids to bring cash to tip the drag queens. I mean, it's just all of Weston, Vermont. A public library had a drag queen story hour for all ages with stories focused on gender and activism. Cambridge, Massachusetts, Chicago, and Amesbury, Massachusetts, Davenport, Iowa, all holding drag queen events for kids at the libraries. Philadelphia school invited drag queen to perform for students this week. Perform for students. Iowa school had a drag performance, teacher, student assembly. Elementary, middle, and high schools across New York have teamed up with a particular drag organization to bring drag queens to school to read to kids throughout the New York City public school system. I mean, can you do nothing about it? I don't know. Do you feel the need to speak on the condition of anonymity? I don't know. I think so. I think most people do. And, of course, that's exactly what they want.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You know, one of the things I would think someone would look for in a spokesbeing,
yeah,
is the ability to articulate ideas, thoughts.
It's been painful.
Positions of the administration. In another stunning indictment of the Ivy League, because Karine Jean-Pierre has a master's from Columbia University. Karine Jean-Pierre tried yesterday to explain the big guy's position on gun control, what exactly his general thoughts are, what he would be supportive of and what he isn't supportive of, including as it pertains to some of the areas that have been mentioned, like the hardening of schools. Here's what she had to say.
We are the only country that is dealing with gun violence at the rate that we're dealing. And other countries have mental health issues. So what's the problem here? And so the problem is with guns and not having legislation to really deal with an issue that is a pandemic here in this country. And so that is not his focus, obviously. And when it comes to schools, and I don't know what he said specifically about schools. I know there's been a conversation about hardening schools. That is not something that he believes in. He believes that we should be able to give teachers the resources to be able to do the job that they're meant to do at schools.
And do it every day.
What was that?
A pandemic in this country, that is a contradiction in terms. The talking point for gun banners, Ms. Jean-Pierre, is epidemic, not pandemic.
Not a pandemic. Well, they can't get their heads out of the COVID.
I understand.
You know? I mean, Lightfoot and Kamala Harris have the same problem.
So in order to extract anything of meaning there for the purposes of discussion, I suppose the one point was, well, yeah, guns are the problem. We want to ban guns. We got that. Biden is opposed to schools hardening themselves as targets. I would like to hear that developed a little bit more. That's a bit surprising that anybody would take that position. I would think that most people would be, even if you're wanting to visit gun laws, would be taking an sort of taking an all of the above approach when it comes to proactive security, in addition to whatever additional regulatory restraints you want on imposed on gun ownership in this country. But apparently that's not the big guy's position, so Ms. Jean-Pierre said. Oh, and by the way, the big guy was meeting with Jacinda Ardern, and who's the PM of New Zealand, in case you forgot.
Oh, yeah, the lockdown queen.
She's also the gun banning queen, and he had high praise for her, what she did with both, because, you know, he shares her authoritarian impulses. He just is unable to have the same success with imposing authoritarian policies that she imposed in New Zealand. For more on this, pleased to be joined by James Gagliano, retired FBI supervisory special agent and a doctoral candidate in Homeland Security at St. John's. He also serves on the board of directors of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund and as a CBS News security and law enforcement analyst. James, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, good to join you. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with the hardening of schools as targets, making schools less vulnerable to something like what happened in Uvalde. What is your view on that?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's certainly a multifaceted issue. It's not a, we can't have a myopic view of this. This isn't just gun control. This isn't just school security. It's got to be a compendium of all these things. And I think it is the height of irresponsibility for any administration that we all hang on every word, listen to, try to understand what's best for our country, to say that that is not even being considered. I think it's foolhardy. It's, you can't go to a major sporting event. You guys are in Chicago. You can't go to a White Sox game or a Cubs game or a Bears game without being wanded, without having single point entry. It just, it boggles the mind, guys. It truly boggles the mind.
We were talking to perhaps a former colleague of yours, Kevin Brock, who was the assistant director of Intel at the FBI yesterday, about some of these same topics. And one of the things he said in particular about the police response in Uvalde is, and some frustrations he had at FBI, is the amount of time it takes for a response to exigent circumstances like an active shooter, because you've got sort of so much training and process, and the SWAT team has to get geared up, and that can take 20 or 30 minutes, and then securing perimeters and positioning everybody and establishing chain of command and so on and so forth, when what you need is to have people trained to stop a threat, to engage that threat as quickly as possible.
Well, and first of all, I've got immense respect for Mr. Brock. I mean, he's spot on there. The notion that you can sit back and wait on a homogenous unit of specially trained and specially equipped, tactical resolution team members, it's foolhardy. We learned that lesson painfully 23 years ago in Columbine, and yet we continue to relearn it. In Columbine, you know, police officers, federal agents, law enforcement officers that responded to that horrific shooting in Colorado, waited in the parking lot and waited for the perfect plan instead of engaging, going in, grabbing a few guys and going in to interdict the gunman. And people died while they were waiting. And so we learned that lesson. And then the baffling aspect of this is we continue to relearn it. And I hate to hear it. It is such a lazy, dishonest intellectual argument to say, well, normal patrol officers aren't equipped or trained to do this. There are only 700, maybe 800,000 police officers in this country. But to wait for these specialty trained units, it's just not responsible, when we know that the average mass shooting like this is typically over in 5 to 7 minutes. You can't get the cavalry there. It's the same thing as saying a line infantry unit in the military has to wait on SEAL Team 6 to get there. No, if you've got a mission, and it's in this instance, it's a matter of saving lives where every second is precious and counts, you've got to go to the sound of the guns.
And he had 77 minutes inside that school, and apparently, according to ABC News, he got in because a teacher propped that door open to go get her cell phone and didn't close it back up. But regardless of that, this morning we're learning that Uvalde police are refusing to cooperate with investigators. So where do they go from here?
Well, here's where they go, Amy. They go to a grand jury with subpoena power. That is absolutely unconscionable. And look, I have great empathy and affinity for the folks that were involved in that initial response. They were there. I was not. It is easy to Monday morning quarterback things. However, if they're not willing to cooperate with an investigation and figure out what happened, because the belief is, and I think it is supported by facts, the belief is that there were wounded children there that probably died because we could not get them to definitive trauma care because of that interminably long wait. 77 minutes, it's unconscionable. You have to go in there and interdict them. And the shrill voices that say, well, these are just patrol officers, or these officers weren't trained in that, that is garbage. That is codswallop. That is not true, because post-Columbine, I can guarantee you every police department has had some type of training in active shooter. And I'm sorry, when you raise your hand and swear that oath, You strap on that sidearm. You pin on that badge. You are the thin blue line between evil and innocence. And if you're going to wait because you don't want to put yourself in harm's way when there are unarmed, precious, innocent children and victims that are at the avail of this evil person, you are in the wrong line of work, guys.
Well, also, when you have parents on scene, they want to go in unarmed, and you're not going in armed. I can't imagine what the relationship between the community and their local police in Uvalde is going to be after this.
It's going to be difficult. And look, police are often unfairly maligned. Police are often accused of things. Police are, you know, we isolate the few bad ones in order to smear the whole, the entire profession.
Right.
And it's not fair. But we also have to be able to stand up to scrutiny. And in this instance, it demands scrutiny. And we have to fix this. And it's painful because it seems like we continue to repeat the errors. It happened in the Pulse nightclub shooting in 2016. It happened in Las Vegas in 2017 at the Country Music Festival, where law enforcement is being too cautious as opposed to interdiction right away.
It happened in Parkland, and there that deputy sheriff in Broward County was charged with child negligence.
Because he sat there, he didn't do anything.
And I wonder if maybe the way there's some accountability here and some repair that happens is that police chief, Pedro Adondo, who apparently gave a stand-down order, if he is charged criminally with what he did.
Yeah, this is something that is a possibility. I know he was just sworn in as a member of the city council in Uvalde,
mm-hmm.
but for them not to be cooperating with the investigation into this, and I know the Department of Justice is now taking this on and will take a look at this, is just the height of irresponsibility. We've got to learn better lessons here. We've got to figure out solutions, and there is no panacea. There's no, you can outlaw this, you can restrict that, you can prohibit this, you can make that illegal. It's not going to stop criminals from getting their hands on weapons. There's 327 million people in this country. There are estimates that there might be 400 million weapons available. Even if you make more restrictions and you pass more laws, it's not going to stop evil people from getting their hands on a weapon and trying to do harm.
Is there any tool that the FBI has its sights on, or that local law enforcement in conjunction with the FBI has their sights on, that is not being used right now that we should be discussing? Maybe it's complicated. Maybe there's a balancing between law and order and civil liberties that needs to be done to incorporate this tool with respect to enforcing the law and preventing these sorts of mass shootings. Anything that's out there that is not part of the discussion, or is not as big a part of the discussion as it should be?
Well, Dan, you certainly just highlighted the problem. And the problem is we live in a country where we cherish our civil liberties, our privacy protections, and the fact that we live and exist in an open society. And yet we want to send our children to school, or our friends to the mall, or our parents to a senior center, and not worry about some deranged, evil person showing up and slaughtering innocents. And how do you do that without imposing martial law? Look, and I don't have any vested interest in any particular devices or any products. I know that there are now products on the market, you know, similar. I think they're called colloquially like a man trap, where you would have cipher locks for doors. And you mentioned that this administration isn't interested in hardened schools. But there are things, as I say to my kids all the time, and I've got five of them, I say to them, if you lock your car doors, that is no guarantee that somebody's not going to break into your car and steal something that's in your glove box. But you make it easier, and evil, bad people, they're like water. They follow the path of least resistance. So if one school takes security more seriously than another school, that may be the difference between that depraved individual, that miscreant, looking at that and saying, hey, I can get in here and cause some harm. So the more that we do harden these locations, have school resource officers that are armed. And here's really the thing. It's not a product. There's not an item. There is no panacea that's going to stop these. But it does go to training. And for this police chief, now, why he was left in charge of a crisis incident like this, of this magnitude, for that length of time without someone else from the Department of Public Safety or the FBI or Customs and Border Patrol, somebody with crisis incident experience, somebody taking the con, as we say in the business, taking control of the situation, is baffling and mind-boggling. And so that's one thing. Training has to be improved, and then there has to be some type of interconnectivity between agencies where once a different agency comes on board, and in this instance it was CBP right off the bat, you turn the scene over to their senior leader, and you don't have the chief of a six-person school police force running a crisis incident like this as the on-scene commander.
He is James Gagliano, retired FBI supervisory special agent, member of the board of directors of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund and CBS News security and law enforcement analyst. James, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, very interested in all the online chatter about this story we covered yesterday, the grading system changes at Oak Park River Forest High School.
You're making quite a splash, yes. People are interested in that.
And especially hearing from partisan hacks who used to be in the journalism, in quotations, business at the Tribune and other outlets. The news outlet that had the story, West Cook News, is a news outlet I'm affiliated with. And so it was characterized as fake news and, you know, pink slime operation to the good name of Oak Park River Forest High School and all these things. Okay. Well, all we did with the story was read from and report from
and
the actual plan that was discussed by the school board at a meeting on May 26th entitled, quote, Transformative Education, Professional Development and Grading. We have the PowerPoint. It's linked. The story recounts slides from the PowerPoint, and it cuts through some of the euphemistic newspeak that Oak Park River Forest administrators and school board members use to cover what they're doing. And what are they doing? They're saying that minority children in their care at that school will not suffer any consequences for misbehavior, for not showing up to school, for not turning in homework. This is a way to level the playing field that is unlevel, they say. But instead of addressing what the actual plan is here, and by the way, this should come as no surprise. This is happening everywhere in some form or fashion. This is just maybe a little bit more aggressive at Oak Park River Forest High School. Rather than doing that, they just attack the messenger. Of course they do, because you can't defend what's being done on the merits once it's exposed, which is why they don't like these things to be exposed. Oh, by the way, one bullet point we didn't get to yesterday, which I think is critically important. 38% of Oak Park River Forest sophomores took the SAT.
And how did they do?
Excuse me, of the sophomores the SAT. Of the sophomores at OPRF who took the SAT, 38% of them failed it. Now, you can't technically fail the SAT, but you know what that means. They basically were below 900 points. They're in the bottom quarter. 38%. The failure rate was 77% for black students, 49% for Hispanic students, 27% for Asian students, 25% for white students. So here's the thing. Those partisan hacks rushing to try to quash this story and smear people reporting on it and smear me because I'm associated with the outlet. And all of their allies in education. Who's been in control of Oak Park River Forest High School? Conservative Republicans?
No, Democrats have.
It's like talking about Chicago public schools. Who's in charge? A bunch of white conservatives like me?
No.
No, never. At least not in the last 50 years. So all of this identitarian nonsense, patronizing as it is, part of it is ideological and you have these Marxist ideologues in positions of authority. Part of it is they have to cover for the awful job that has been done educating children of all races over the last 50 years as the quality of students coming out of K through 12 continues to be at best static. And among those they spend the most time obsessing about, it's worse, much worse. I mean, the scholarship of Thomas Sowell and many others, Walter Williams, dearly departed Walter Williams, tackles this too in terms of where black students were in terms of their academic prowess when the laws were explicitly racist in this country, like under Jim Crow, as compared to where they are today. You think the promise of Brown v. Board of Education has been realized? Who thinks that has happened? Substantively, raise your hand. Nobody should be raising their hand. It hasn't been. Why? Why? Why do you think that is? Who's in charge of K through 12 education and who has been since Brown v. Board, more or less? Certainly a decade removed from Brown v. Board, so for the last 50 years, and particularly for the last 30. And what is the result? So how do you defend it? You don't. You say white conservatives hate you. You say they're saying bad things about you. You create two or three systems of academic performance standards. And you just paper it over it and pass people on until they're somebody else's problem, not yours anymore. And you tell yourself, I'm doing it all in the name of racial equity. And people have an infinite capacity to delude themselves, as we see playing out, particularly in education. It's a disgrace. Oak Park River Forest High School? That's a disgrace.
Oh, and they responded to your article. They pointed out a statement saying that that's true. This is not a true article.
That's not a response.
I know. Oh, right. And then they said that that was not discussed at the Board of Ed's meeting May 26th.
Mm-hmm. Well, they can give me chapter and verse on the PowerPoint and...
Oh, yeah, I'd like to... Yeah, I mean, how would you even know
Paul Rossi at Grace Church in Manhattan, one of the, you know, the preeminent private schools in Manhattan. I'm resigning as a math teacher because the administration is telling me that I have to treat my students differently based on race, and I won't do it. Oak Park River Forest, I mean, this is 5 years ago. They had black-only student assemblies.
I think it's 3 years. Yeah, well...
So, yeah, grade school in Atlanta, where a black mom is suing because they literally are teaching black kids in one class and white kids in another class. So the whole point of Brown v. Board was separate but equal doesn't hold water. And now you have those in charge of K through 12 education creating separate but equal paradigms in K through 12 education. And look at the performance. For more on this, pleased to be joined by William Allen, professor of political philosophy at Michigan State University, former chief operating officer of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education in D.C., and editor of new book, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. Professor Allen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Chicago. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. I see your book has essays from some friends of this show, including the great Glenn Lowry, who's an econ professor at Brown University. He recently won the Bradley Prize up there at the Bradley Foundation in Wisconsin. And he this is part of the speech he gave accepting that award. He said, racial disparities are real, of course, but at the end of the day, just how important is race as such? Inequality in America is not mainly a racial issue. Many poor and marginalized white people deserve our concern, too. Is race an undeniable difference between people, or is it a social construct? interracial marriage has grown dramatically, as has the number of people viewing themselves as multiracial, including the first black president and vice president of the country. He goes on to say, I take no pleasure in doing so, but feel obliged to report this reality. Equality of dignity, equality of standing, of honor, of security in one's position within society, and equal ability to command the respect of others, such things simply cannot be handed over, nor will they be the fruit of insurrection, violent uprising, or rebellion. Equality of this sort is something we must wrest with our bare hands from a cruel and indifferent world by means of our own effort, inspired by the example of our enslaved and newly freed ancestors. How do you react to that review of the landscape?
You will find that to be perfectly an echo of what Glenn Lowry writes in The State of Black America and what other essays in there report quite comprehensively. The essay by Robert Bland, who tells the history post-slavery of the patriotic exertions of American blacks. The essays I've written and the essays in the 14th Amendment by Edward Erler, all of them come together to give a clear picture of what the past was and why there was for a long time, nearly 100 years after the end of slavery, enormous progress in the face of the greatest repression, all of which is now denied, which is assailed by such falsehoods as those retailed in the New York Times 1619 project. So what I think about what Glenn's comments were upon receiving the Bradley Prize is that, amen, you are continuing to spread what we have been able to demonstrate through the course of our elaborate researches and reporting in the State of Black America.
Ian Rowe, a friend of the show, clearly a friend of yours as well, also has an essay in your book, and he's excellent, too. He's got a new book out himself. We're looking to have him on the show in the near term to discuss that. But a concept that he focuses a lot on, as do other scholars, but I think he's particularly persuasive on the topic, considering his success in education, agency, and this idea that so much of the paternalist attitudes and programs strip people that are enmeshed in them from agency, and our culture is promoting this the stripping of agency from people they describe as marginalized or downtrodden in some way.
Very much so, in fact. What Ian has done is to develop even more intensively what has been a consistent line of presentation for many of us over the course of several years now, namely that we are in the midst of a period, a campaign period, to inject into the veins of the culture racism with a capital R, and to deny that there ever was any agency in those who left slavery and entered into freedom. But the historical record refutes that. It demonstrates quite the opposite. And this attack on agency, let me say it this way. When Lyndon Johnson declared equal opportunity is not enough in 1965, he was saying to black people in particular, you can't do it. You're not capable.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, it is the very promise of the American heritage that all human beings are capable of self-government. And it is not merely a promise. It was a demonstrated reality in the first hours after slavery. Between 1860 and 1890, the freed slave population doubled. There was an incredible population growth rate, demographic explosion. The rate of family formation equally dramatically increased. The attainment of literacy to 50% level by 1920, and economic progress. And all those things took place in the face of the most severe repression. People demonstrated their sense of agency, that they could do what Booker T. Washington argued they could do, which is they could build themselves into what they aspired to be, or what Langston Hughes referred to as a dream deferred was, in fact, at that time, really a dream being realized.
Professor Allen, how do you feel? I mean, you just heard the story about Oak Park River Forest High School and their efforts to equalize test scores among racial groups so they can no longer be docked for missing class, misbehaving in school, or failing to turn in their assignments. What message does that send to the minorities in this country?
This is a repetition of the equal opportunity is not enough message, and I can't emphasize strongly enough
This idea of dependent victimhood, that you cannot do it, has disabled, now moving on to two generations of Americans who are suffering as a direct result of it. It's worse than mere paternalism. It is really a forceful repression of exertion, of individual exertion. And it is that lack of individual exertion that Glenn Lowry was talking about in his acceptance remarks at the Bracket Prize. You can, in fact, reinforce one of two things, either resignation or aspiration. And we are living in a time in which there is a great campaign, a rhetorical push to encourage resignation rather than aspiration, and it is having disastrous consequences in American communities, and there in Oak Park and Chicago, we see examples of it.
Sorry, I was just writing that down. That was a wonderful turn of a phrase. Something else that Lowry touches upon and others I wanted to get your reaction to, and he makes this point in his speech again, I refer to it, not only that he's many things, he is a black man in this country, beneficiary of the Civil Rights Revolution, descendant of slaves. He's also a patriot who loves his country. He's also a man of the West. And his point that he makes often, which is Western scholarship, the Western canons, they belong to me just as they belong to any man or woman of the West or the world over. This idea, the 1619 Project is probably a good example of it, that these important works from, you know, the ancient Greeks to present are just the product of, white cultures, white Eurocentrism and so forth. Nonsense. They're part of the great works of human civilization over the many centuries. And they're part of the oeuvre from which I draw as I try to make sense of this world and comment on it.
Yes, and more importantly, all these things are part of the great push in humankind towards liberation, towards the development of freedom, mm-hmm. towards the development of individualism. So it's not simply that these things are of value to all of us who think and will reflect on our circumstances, but they are a distinctive mark such that the whole globe has been affected by the civilizational development, which has made the standard of natural rights, of human rights, of liberty, a standard applicable to all. And you cannot reject that past without rejecting the promise of freedom. That is the critical matter. And those who are attacking the United States and the heritage of the United States are deliberately, at least in the case of some of them, attacking precisely that heritage. They want to see the United States as a culture, as a civilization overthrown. And we must understand that. And I don't want to paint everyone with that brush. There are some goodwill people who are simply mistaken. But there are many who are not mistaken, who know exactly what they're doing, and who spread racial division, inject the poison into the cultural veins deliberately because they wish to see it overthrown.
He is William Allen. He's a professor of political philosophy at Michigan State, former chief operating officer of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education in D.C., and the editor of the new book, The State of Black America, Progress, Pitfalls, and the Promise of the Republic. Do pick that up. Professor Allen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, and you're most welcome.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Brian Deese is chief economic advisor to the big guy. He was on with Bill Hemmer responding to the continued surge in gas prices and the general inflationary environment yesterday. Don't worry, the big guy's got a plan.
This president and our entire team understands that when the price goes up at the pump, typical families feel it. And as you're to your point, when the price of diesel goes up, it affects logistics and transportation costs. And this is, unfortunately, the impact of Putin's war in Ukraine. The price of diesel and gas at the pump are up more than $1.50 since Putin started amassing troops at the border because we've brought Russian oil off the market and Russian refinery capacity to create diesel off the market as well. But that's why we are focused on doing everything we prudently can while keeping the pressure on Vladimir Putin.
Deal with the Putin price hike, but we also have to liberate Ukraine. And so we're all suffering a little bit because of what Putin did. But don't worry, we're on the job. We're battling Putin on two fronts, the inflationary front that he's imposed on the United States, as well as his destabilizing of the New World Order. That's the sales pitch they're offering. I don't think it's being terribly persuasive. But for more on this, please be joined by Steve Moore for our weekly conversation, economist, author of Trumponomics, and most recently, GovZilla. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. You mean to say that you don't believe what Joe Biden said in his Wall Street Journal piece yesterday?
Well,
what you're telling me?
I'm sure he wrote it, right, well, Mr. Moore?
Deese just gave
a summary of that op-ed, which was just a bunch of euphemism strung together. There's nothing concrete there.
Well, I mean, to Amy's point, I guarantee you he didn't write it. I don't even know if you read it. I wonder who did write it. But my favorite line in that, I mean, the thing was really, where are the fact checkers, right? Because one of his big claims was that, gee, no president has, in modern times, has reduced the deficit more than I have. Really? This is a guy, I mean, do you look at his first year in office? He increased the debt with his spending bills by $3 trillion. Yeah. No president going back to George Washington has done that. And so for him to be claiming somehow he's like, you know, some super debt cutter is like Al Capone was a crime fighter in Chicago.
Well, yeah, but when nobody cares about the budget deficit right now, the country's in debt. We care about feeding our families because especially people on a fixed budget.
That's true.
Gas this morning in L.A., the average price, $6.92. Here in Illinois, it's now the average price. It jumped 5 cents overnight. It's $5 a gallon or more in Illinois.
Yep, it's happening, as you said, all over the country. There are now, I think, 12 states that have gas over the price of $5 a gallon. By the way, I was looking at the map. I think you guys might find this interesting, of where the price of gasoline is over $5 a gallon. In 11 of those 12 states, they're blue states. So I don't know if there's a relationship there, but you know, in states run by Democrats, the gas price is higher because they hate gasoline. And look, I don't even think that Putin would have gone into Russia. I mean, Ukraine in the first place if Trump were still president. I think he saw weakness. He saw that there was no resolve by this administration after what happened in Afghanistan, and he marched into Ukraine. So, look, my big problem right now, Dan and Amy, with this administration is they refuse to take any responsibility for anything that's happening. They keep acting like all these world events are out of their control, when in fact the president of the United States has a huge impact on what, not just what happens with gas prices and things like that here, but what's happening all over the world. I got to tell you one other quick story. I was in Colorado last weekend giving a talk to the Auto Dealers Association in Colorado. And the biggest auto dealer in Denver came up to me after my talk, and he said, Steve, he said, I normally have 1,100 cars on my lot, you know, that I'm preparing for sale. You know how many cars he has on the lot today?
How many?
60.
Oh.
So, you know, that means when you go to, talk about inflation, Amy, that means if you go into a new car showroom virtually everywhere in the country, normally what you would do is haggle the price down. Now, my friend was saying you have to pay $10,000 above the sticker price to get a car.
Did you say haggle? Is it haggle? Did they say haggle in Virginia?
Exactly. I've done that. You know, you could say, okay, yeah, this car is $26,000, right. But I'll pay $22,000 for it. You know, but you can't do that now. You can't do it.
Little confab with Jay Powell yesterday and the president. The Fed is going to remain independent. We're not going to meddle with monetary policy, but it's important to have these conversations. I mean, Powell just got, another 6-year term. So what Biden has to say is probably not particularly material to what he does. I'm not worried about the quote unquote independence of the Fed. I'm worried about Jay Powell's decision making specifically.
Me too. Yeah, you and I think exactly alike. And he was reappointed. I think it was like 80-20 or something like that. And I was surprised that so many Republicans, you know, voted for him, because he's, you know, look, you judge somebody by their record. And Jay Powell's policies have contributed to, you know, the highest inflation in 40 years. Now, it's really interesting, because I want to make sure your listeners understand that you have kind of co-conspirators here in Biden and in Jerome Powell. So Biden has this massive tidal wave of government spending and debt, that all debt finance. Okay. And then what Powell did was he accommodated all that government spending by doing what? He printed money. He just flushed all this cheap dollars into the economy to pay for all the debt spending. Well, obviously you're going to get inflation there. By the way, did you see even Janet Yellen admitted she was wrong about inflation?
Yeah, she made a bit of a boo-boo.
Finally did her mea culpa.
Yeah.
Only a year and a half late. But and I have to say, I mean, how many weeks, Amy, on this show have I been saying week after week after week after week for over a year that we're going to, that if they don't do something about this out of control government spending and this war on American energy, we're going to have inflation. And here we have it, and everybody's scratching their head saying, gee, where did that come from?
No, I didn't. I knew as soon as I was getting those monster checks for my kids that
exactly.
We're going to have to pay on the back end. I just wish I would have put it in savings and waited for this. Because guess what? I got to go to the grocery store again today, and I don't want to go. And you used to go not to one store, but you always have to go to two different stores to find items that you even need. And then when you get them, it's out of control. Something that was $10 last week will be $12 this week.
And, you know, when I do your show, I was back in Chicago for a day or two over Memorial Day weekend. And people, you know, I know people are listening to the Dan and Amy show, because people would come up and say, oh, hey, Steve Moore, you're on the Dan and Amy show. And then they yell at me. You know why? You know why they yell at me?
Why?
They say, Steve, stop telling Dan and Amy that inflation is 8%. It's not 8%. He said, I'm paying 70% more for my gas. I'm 25% more for my home heating. I'm paying, you know, 30% more for my food. I'm not paying 8% more inflation. I'm paying 20% more inflation. That's the way most Americans feel, because the essentials that you have to buy are so much more expensive.
Well, and so, okay, then with respect to what the big guy said and Dee said, Dee's saying, you know, we're now in this period where we're transitioning to more stable, resilient growth. It was great economic newspeak. But ultimately, that there isn't anything they can do, because they've unleashed the beast. So all this talk about the government's going to fix supply chains and infrastructure and reduce the, I mean, all of that is irrelevant. That there is nothing that they have shown a willingness to do that will have any material impact. So this is going to have to unwind itself with what Jay Powell does and the market's reaction to that, in combination with the market, how resilient these markets are that still have supply chain issues.
Well, I think you've understated the problem, Dan, with all due respect, because not only did they not have a solution, but people should actually go back and read that piece by Joe Biden. Everything he said, I have three solutions to the inflation problem. The solution number one was more green energy subsidies. Really? We're going to solve inflation with windmills? Is there anybody who really believes that? Number two, he said, we got to soak the rich with higher taxes. How are you going to get inflation down with more taxes on our businesses? And the third thing he said is price controls. We're going to put price controls on those evil drug companies and the energy companies and the meat producers and the poultry producers. It's like, did you notice, Dan, as soon as Joe Biden became president, all these companies got greedy?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, right. This is the standard playbook. I mean, look, this guy is stuck in a bygone era. They're like the Illinois Republican Party. There's like just stuck with talking points from the Reagan era. So is Joe Biden. In his op-ed in the Journal, he uses the phrase trickle down economics. I mean, they're completely captured by the talking points they've been muttering for 40 years.
Well, look, the thing that we're – he keeps saying like these things are events that are out of his control. Why are gas prices higher? Because he declared war on American oil and gas. And they admitted last week that they like higher oil and gas prices, because it means people will use less of it. And then you've got this issue of, oh, the supply chain problems, that's the problem. Well, do either of you recall any of these supply chain problems when Trump was president? I mean, come on. These are a result of bad policies, folks. And if Biden would say, and at the end of his piece, he said, don't worry, folks, I'm willing to work with the Republicans to solve these problems. When? Where? When has he ever, name one thing he's done that's moved to the middle? I mean, seriously, or reached out to Republicans. He doesn't, they don't even talk to the Republicans.
And on speaking of the Republicans on that side of the aisle, is the posture, and do you agree with it, if I'm characterizing it correctly, that they're just going to continue to beat the big guy about the head and neck area over inflation and not really talk much about what a pro-growth GOP economic agenda would look like?
Well, you know, I think there is a big move to have a kind of new contract with America. I forget what they're calling it, but basically setting out down about 10 principles that Republicans will pursue. And those are all, you know, positive things like, you know, health savings accounts and more choice for parents and getting control of government spending, making the Trump tax cuts permanent. But look, I'm not here to say rah-rah Republican. You know me, Dan Amy. I'm not. Look, Republicans are sometimes almost as bad as the Democrats. And so just having Republicans take Congress, which they will, is not going to solve the problem. You need some radical surgery here in terms of changing the direction of things. My God, you know, they had that bill, the $40 billion for Ukraine funding, and our good friend Rand Paul, I don't know if you've ever had Rand on your show, but I love Rand Paul. He's one of my favorite senators. He said, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't we actually pay for this to cover government spending? And even the Republicans didn't want to do that.
Right. Right.
I mean, so...
That, right. That sort of is an answer with an example. No message received. Steve Moore, economist, Trumponomics author, as well as more recently Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy and Our Freedom. Steve, thanks as always.
All right, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know last week Dr. Allison Arwadi elevated the COVID threat level in Chicago from avocado to asparagus.
No, it went from orange to red. We're in high now.
Right. So we're at asparagus, which you may want to take notice of. I don't know what it means or the words that you said. I don't know what they mean as it pertains to COVID either. But apparently they're important because she's standing at a podium talking about it. So it must be important. This in The Lancet, trying to reestablish itself as a serious medical journal. Revisiting pediatric COVID-19 cases in counties with and without school mask requirements, U.S., July to October of 2021.
And what did they find out?
The researchers here at The Lancet. Centers for Disease Control in the U.S. have released multiple observational studies suggesting that school mask mandates significantly reduce case rates. However, there have been numerous additional U.S. and international observational studies finding no significant effect on school mask mandates on pediatric cases. So what they did is to replicate a highly cited CDC study showing a negative association between school mask mandates and cases. We then extend the study using a larger sample of districts and a longer time interval, employing almost six times as much data as the original study. We examine the relationship between mask mandates and per capita pediatric cases using multiple regression to control for differences across school districts. The findings, this is funded by the University of Toronto. Findings.
Yes.
Replicating the CDC study shows similar results. However, incorporating a larger sample and longer period showed no significant relationship between mask mandates and case rates. The results persisted when using regression models to control for differences across districts. School districts that chose to mandate masks are likely to be systematically different from those who do not in multiple, often unobserved ways. We failed to establish a relationship between school masking and pediatric cases using the same methods, but a larger, more nationally diverse population over a longer interval. Dr. Marty Makary, reacting to the results of this study, Dr. Marty Makary, John Hopkins University. The study demonstrates how the CDC was cherry-picking data to support their school mask dogma. The article states that the CDC's journal rejected publishing this reanalysis, most likely because it exposed the CDC's salami slicing of data and use of science as political propaganda. Well, that's a good predicate for our next guest because of what the city of Chicago has done to itself over the last 2+ years as the Rona busters have imposed COVID policies that we're just getting a handle on in terms of the damage inflicted.
Well, what about shutting down the lakefront? All 18 miles, you couldn't walk on the bike path, you couldn't ride a bike on the bike path, you couldn't go to the beach.
Yeah, that's not as long-lasting as shutting down the schools. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Paul Vallis, former superintendent of the Bridgeport Public Schools in Connecticut and the Recovery School District in Louisiana, and, of course, CPS as well. Paul, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. Surprise, surprise on the CDC study. If you recall, Dan, Amy and I talked about that CDC study that looked at, I think they were looking at students in Georgia, about a year and a half ago when it came out, when I guest hosted one morning. I think we spent about a half an hour on it. I mean, what they did with the kids with these schools shutdowns across the country was absolutely criminal. And you know, when you look at the huge spike in murder rates of school-aged children and violent crime committed by school-aged children, you can put it on the laps of the Chicago Teachers Union leadership and their forced shutdown of the school district where campuses were literally closed for 15 consecutive months.
Well, so let's talk about this in the context of a mayoral campaign. If you're mayor of the city of Chicago, whether it's an appointed board or elected board at CPS, it's sort of functionally the same, or it should be. What is your approach going to be as you still have these COVIDians, the Rona busters and their ilk, keeping things like masking? I mean, they're promoting indoor masking just as of last week. There's no evidence to support the policy. What is your position going to be with respect to lockdowns, mask mandates, and the like?
Well, look, I've always said that I consider masking to be optional for the parents. If the parents want their child to wear a mask, that parent can decide. I've obviously opined continuously on the just the inappropriateness of the school mask mandates. That said and done, look, I think three things have to be done to the Chicago Public Schools, and when I'm mayor, I will be able to do it. The first thing is that the system needs to – they need to go to a pure school choice system. In other words, direct funding to families so that the families can decide what school is best for their child, whether it's parochial, private, whether it's charters. They also need to lift the cap on charters. There's no way to break this monopoly, but they have a pure school choice system. Trying to reform the existing system is like Gorbachev trying to fix the Soviet Union. At the end of the day, there is no alternative but school choice. I also think what they need to do, Dan, is they need to also empower the communities, like they're doing in Indianapolis, in Camden, in Denver with the innovation schools and Renaissance schools, that when a community has a failing school, the community has the right to select another school model. And if that model is a charter school model, so be it, because children, the community should not, should be in a position to demand that a failing school be restructured and reconstituted. And third, that district needs to be broken up. Only 60% of the $9.3 billion that is spent on public education in Chicago finds its way into classroom instruction. And that is criminal. So it's not a funding problem. It's a funding priority problem. So parental choice, community empowerment, and radical decentralization so the money can really follow the kids.
That sounds good, but CTU is not going to like anything you just said.
Yeah, well, let me respond by saying that the mayor is going to have a 2-year window to really do it before the elected school board is in effect. And you can, the city council can actually create a school choice system. And look, for those who say, well, you're not going to get support of the city council, look, the mayor has been driving, has been totally antagonistic toward the city council, but she hasn't lost a vote yet. Believe me, you can build a coalition of parochial school, private school parents, those parents who are angry and frustrated with the public schools, the conservative unions like police and fire, and those taxpayers, the overwhelming vast majority of Chicago taxpayers don't even have kids in the Chicago public schools. So there is a coalition that can be built to counter the teachers' union to implement those reforms.
So Paul Vallis is running for mayor again this cycle. Mm-hmm. And a vote for Paul Vallis for mayor is a vote for what?
It's a vote for public safety. And I think I've articulated on your show, as well as in numerous op-ed pieces and posts, what I would do specifically for the Chicago Public Schools, for public safety, beginning with the firing of Superintendent Brown and his entire leadership team, and the movement back to community policing, and the movement and a return to proactive policing. Obviously, I've articulated my views on the schools, parental choice and community empowerment. And in third, on the budget, look, the mayor controls $28 billion in spending. You have to look at the budget holistically. And the budgets need to be reprioritized so that their budgets are investment vehicles and not dependency vehicles. And that can be done. And that's something that I've done routinely in the multi-billion dollar institutions that I've taken over the years. So balancing the budget while not increasing property taxes and holding the line on things like fines and fees obviously would also be a third part of my triad of initiatives, so to speak.
But I mean, across policy areas, K through 12, public safety, budget, tax policy, what is the essence of Paul Vallis? What is Paul Vallis bringing to those topics and any other that he would confront as mayor?
Well, three things. A realization that you can't have stable growing communities if you don't have safe communities. So public safety needs to be a priority. And that means you need real community policing, a real police presence, and you need to allow the police to do their jobs with the proper supervision and accountability. I crossed the Rubicon on school choice in 1995 when I told the American Federation an AFT convention, when asked a school choice question about vouchers, I said, I'm not going to oppose anything that provides educational opportunities for poor children. So, I mean, I literally created a 100% school choice city in New Orleans. So I think my credentials is pretty solid there. And Dan, as you know, I've tackled multi-billion-dollar institutions that have been in crisis, beginning with the Chicago budget in 93, and then, of course, the schools, Philadelphia, et cetera. And I've always been able to find a way to hold the line on taxes and to convert budgets into really community investment vehicles. Because if you're not investing in the type of things that help grow a city, the city's going to continue to decline. And that's what we have right now. We have a declining city. We're down to 16% of the city constituting middle-income residents. And that's down from 50% when I graduated high school. That's a disaster. As you well know, a city can't grow and prosper if it has a declining, disintegrating middle class. And that's what we're experiencing in Chicago today.
Well, so, okay. So thinking about this race in 2023, yeah, as compared to your previous run in 2019, let's just focus there. Lessons learned. I mean, you have the resume for the job. You have the aptitude and the skill sets for the job. I don't think people question that. But for some reason, you don't catch fire in Chicago. This is sort of the rap on you, and you know this. So, and you got lost in the shuffle last go around with half a dozen candidates. Yes. There's going to be half a dozen candidates again, including this time an incumbent mayor, a weak incumbent, but nonetheless an incumbent. What lesson did you learn from 4 years ago that's going to be applied in 2023 so you don't get lost in the shuffle again?
Well, first of all, there were, I think, 14 candidates in the last election. And as you know, before Rahm Emanuel got out, I was actually right behind Willie Wilson, and there was going to be a runoff. And in a runoff, I would have beaten Rahm. But then, of course, you know, he got out and 7-8 other candidates got into the race. Every campaign has a different dynamic. It has its own dynamic. And this dynamic is that 4 years ago, crime wasn't at front and center like it is today. Well, now it is with a vengeance. 4 years ago, we hadn't been, you know, having an election after three school work stoppages and a response to COVID, which literally devastated the school system, not to mention devastated the economy. And 3 years ago, the financial crisis, while significant, was not at the level it is now, because the mayor has basically has used COVID money to balance her last two budgets. So I think the dynamic is different. You know, so people like to say, well, where's your constituency? Sometimes they're more brutal and they say, where's your tribe? Well, look, my constituency is anybody who believes public safety is a number one priority. I believe that my constituency is anyone who believes that the school system is totally inadequate and, in effect, disintegrating, and that we need real school choice. And my constituency is anybody who believes that the city should be run by somebody who knows how to run billion-dollar enterprises, because most of the candidates I'll be running against have never run anything, perhaps, you know, with the exception of their legislative offices. So at the end of the day, I think that's my tribe. I think that's my constituency. People want a safe city. People want real educational choice, and people who want fiscally responsible government. And I think on based on my experience and my credentials, and obviously having enough financial support, which this time I believe I will have to get my message out, I believe I'll be successful.
Well, I mean, to have public safety, you need police officers. And my goodness, they used to fill up the United Center with police candidates, you know, who are vying for it. Now you can apply online. Alderman O'Shea wants to give a cash incentive to police officers who
sign up. Yeah.
And, Pash, what do you think about that idea, and how would you attract people to become police officers?
Well, let me tell you how. You know, when my son returned from Afghanistan, he wanted so badly to be a Chicago police officer. I don't even think he could get on the list to take the police exam, okay? Now, you know, so at the end of the day, you know, you shouldn't have to give incentives for people to become a Chicago police officer. But I think if you do a number of things, you'll change the dynamic. First of all, you need to replace that leadership team, and you need to promote people into positions of responsibility based on time and grade and experience and accomplishment. If you do that, that will help restore morale. Secondly, you need to support the cops, which means you need to allow them to be proactive in their policing, and you need to protect them and support them. And I'm not talking about not holding people accountable. That's not what I'm talking about. And the third thing you need to do is you need to have to go back to a community policing strategy where you're putting cops in the neighborhoods on the local beats, and you're not moving them around. You're not putting them on 12-hour days and 12-hour regular 12-hour schedules. You're not canceling their days off. I think if you do those three things, you will slow the exodus of police officers, and you'll make being a Chicago police officer an attractive job again, because I don't think it's going to take a while to turn around. And, you know, I spent about 8 months helping the police negotiate an 8-year contract with the city. So I've immersed myself in the police leadership. I've immersed myself with the rank and file. And I'm convinced if I'm elected, I can slow the exodus of officers and once again make the Chicago Police Department an attractive place for potential for those individuals who are interested in a career in public safety.
Would you get rid of the vaccine mandates for Chicago police officers, firefighters, and CPS teachers?
Yeah, I think the vaccine mandate should be look, I'm a choice guy. You know, I think the vaccine mandate should be optional, and I think the masking mandate should be optional too. I mean, people are old enough and intelligent enough and mature enough to make their own decisions.
And so on the racial politics of the city, I mean, you're starting to sort of get into it when you're mentioning, you know, who's your tribe. So it sounds like your play is to try to transcend the racial politics of the city rather than play racial politics, which is sort of all well and good on paper. But in a city that's as stratified by race as Chicago, can you do that?
Yeah, well, I believe you can. Look, I've run schools in cities I've run school districts that were overwhelmingly Black and Latino, and that were overwhelmingly high poverty, and yet I was extremely popular in each of those cities. And in fact, based on my experience and record in Chicago, I almost got elected. I almost got elected governor. Of course, Dan, you remember I lost by 1.5 percentage points.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, I believe I think the issue of crime transcends race. and tribe, so to speak. I think the issue of school choice and quality of schools transcends race and tribes. I think, affordable living. The city has the highest property taxes, sales taxes, and fines and fees as any big city in America. I think, you know, the cost of living transcends tribes. So I think I'm going to win on the issues. I've always respected people's intelligence. And when it comes to identifying what they really need. And I think on those three issues, I will win. I will also be prepared to retort. I mean, when the union's out there saying, oh my God, school choice is racist. School choice is will deprive public schools of needed resources. My response is there's nothing more racist than an institution that literally limits people's choices, primarily individuals who are overwhelmingly poor and low income and minority, to a failing school based on where they happen to live and what their zip code has to be. You know, I believe that what I'm talking about and what I'm advocating for are things that can provide real opportunities and a real chance for individuals to transcend their social economic status. And I think there's nothing more important than allowing parents the right to select the best school for their child. There's nothing more important for the money to follow the child to that respective school.
He is Paul Vallis. He's a candidate for mayor of Chicago in 2023. Paul, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Paul, do you have a website where people can go to learn more about you or help out?
Yeah, well, they can find my posts on Paul Vallis, on Paul Vallis, my Facebook posts, and our website will be up later on today.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Paul. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, Aurora Mayor Richard Ervin, candidate backed by Ken Griffin's $50 million, running in the Republican primary for governor, despite having voted in 7 of the last 8 Democrat primaries, despite not being willing to admit that he didn't vote for Trump, despite the fact that he called Trump a bigoted racist and an idiot.
I have the text messages to prove it, yeah.
Despite characterizing himself as a enthusiastic supporter of capital BLM, Black Lives Matter. Stop with this wordplay of do you think Black Lives Matter, small BLM? Do you think all lives matter? We're talking about the organization. That's the only thing that's germane. The Marxist organization that wants to destroy the nuclear family, that capital BLM. Well, after capital BLM and their cohorts laid waste to the city of Aurora, Richard Ervin City, while he was mayor in the summer of 2020. You had the reporting there from the dutiful Chicago Press Corps. Police cars on fire.
Stores looted. Businesses set on fire. And he said that he was supporting BLM because he wanted to appease them so that they would not burn down a city, which they did anyway.
Well, that was also something he came up with
after he said it.
After he made him, he said, I'm a supporter of them, enthusiastic supporter, which was a year after they laid waste to the city. So none of it makes any sense because there's no sense to be made. It's flimflammery. Well, before he filled out that candidate questionnaire expressing his enthusiastic support for Black Lives Matter in the spring of 2021, after the rioting in the summer of 2020 in June, Irvin participated in a law and justice seminar by Zoom hosted by Roosevelt University. And here's what he had to say about the rioting that occurred in his town.
And I saw as the drones went overhead as, you know, things on fire, police cars on fire, my downtown just on fire and people running around destroying things. You know, I was conflicted. And in the other hand, I recognize that unless there's some type of disruption, you know, in what we want here in our country, things won't change. Just to simply knock on somebody's door and say, you know, I want equity and fairness, you know, without disruption, without anything behind it, it just doesn't work. I mean, we've been doing that for years since the 60s, you know, and the only reason Dr. King, the main reason Dr. King and those guys and those freedom fighters back then, you know, got a lot of the things that they asked for is because news media started televising it.
Conflicted about the rioting, the cop cars on fire, the businesses that were vandalized and looted. Conflicted about that because disruption is necessary. Number one. Number two, making a comparison to Martin Luther King and the Freedom Fighters. I don't know. Maybe I need to brush up on my civil rights history. I thought the power of the Martin Luther King led civil rights movement was civil disobedience, not rioting and looting and violence. Maybe it's Richard Irvin who needs to brush up on his history. But this is a candidate who suggests he's going to be a law and order governor who's having a press conference today to talk about
new plans for safety.
The public safety crisis in Chicago and Illinois.
Yeah.
And you wonder why you have the city and state you have here in Illinois. And you wonder why you have cities and states that have public safety crises that are lorded over by Democrat socialists. In New York, you have Kathy Hochul, who's part of the, you know, sort of defund the police movement when it was all courant. And now she wants to, in the wake of the Buffalo massacre, now she wants a new special police squad that focuses on social media. So these defund the policers can't figure out where they are. They want to defund the police until they want to expand police power into and police presence on social media. More on all this, we're pleased to be joined by George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the American Spectator, who blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be with you.
Yeah, I'm just confused about the response from the left and some, I guess, who are pretending to be on the center right, like this candidate for governor we have in Illinois, where on the one hand, they're praising lawlessness and disorder or rationalizing at minimum. They're defunding the police. Their police are part of the systemic racism that afflicts this country. It's a systemically racist institution, consent decrees in the eye. And then on the other hand, we got a public safety crisis. We need more police. We need to harden targets. We need interagency cooperation. We need new special units for more and better monitoring of social media and so forth.
Yeah, well, consistency has never been the strong suit of that crowd. And I guess it comes down to what do you want to use the police for? If you want to use it to suppress free speech, if you want to have police agencies going around regulating people's social beliefs, then maybe that's a good thing in their opinion. But heaven forbid you have them maintain order in the streets. You're talking to the wrong guy if you're looking for somebody who could actually make sense of what the left is up to.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I understand the confusion. The situation in Philadelphia is metastasizing the way it has, several years ago now in Chicago under Larry Krasner and the civilian political leadership there. Since that's your sort of home base, you know, give us a profile of what's happening there that may be instructive to help us understand what's happening here.
Well, excuse me, Larry Krasner, before he became district attorney, was in private practice of law, and he sued the Philadelphia Police Department over 75 times in federal court and made quite a bit of money doing that. And he then became the district attorney thanks to $1.4 million provided by George Soros to him, which is, by the way, unheard of money for a district attorney's race in Philadelphia. And so with that mindset, Krasner has proceeded to basically decriminalize everything in Philadelphia. And we have the highest murder tally last year. We hit 562 homicides, which it used to be it topped out around 300 or so per year. Under Krasner, we hit 562. Carjackings are up by 500%. Retail theft is up. I mean, the whole city is just falling apart. And Krasner continues to be backed by the progressive left and our progressive mayor. And by the way, our teenage police commissioner, who is Danielle Outlaw, who had been the police commissioner in Portland, Oregon, which had a 400-person police department. She's now supposedly in charge of a 3,600-person police department here in Philadelphia. She hasn't the slightest idea what she's doing. So you've got a triumvirate. You got Larry Krasner, the super liberal progressive DA, working in conjunction with Danielle Outlaw, the teenage police commissioner, doesn't know what she's doing. Headed up by Jim Kenney, who is a hopelessly progressive mayor who thinks everything is just going swimmingly in Philadelphia. In the meantime, people are moving out of Philadelphia. They want nothing to do with it. People who used to come in from the suburbs to, you know, patronize the restaurants and the museums and whatever in Philadelphia, they're staying away. And so we're developing a situation that's beginning to look a lot like Escape from New York.
Well, it's, and gee, Amy, does what George just described, does that sound familiar at all? I mean, that's our troika with Lightfoot, Fox, and Brown as the police chief, and you know, the same thing going on here. I wonder, in just comparing and contrasting, you know, Pennsylvania, you've got a governor's race too. I wonder how much public safety, and particularly what's happened in Philadelphia, is informing the governor's race there with Mastriani going up against the AG.
Well, I think it'll be an issue, but you've got to understand Philadelphia is the kind of the power base for Josh Shapiro, who is the Attorney General of Pennsylvania. He's from the Philadelphia suburbs, and that's going to be his main area of support in the race. Mastriano has been described as a hard right Republican who challenged the result of the 2020 election and tried to get the Republican-controlled legislature. He was in the state legislature, state senator. He tried to get the Republican legislature to take action because clearly the election was just stolen outright in Pennsylvania. I know you're not allowed to say that out loud, but I'll say it. And Mastriano recognized that, and the Republicans, being the Republicans, couldn't muster the courage to get behind Mastriano's move to challenge the outcome of that election. So that's going to be the real issue in this thing. You're going to have
But just on the public safety piece in Philadelphia, because, you know, just yeah. I mean, you just is the feeling. Philadelphia is just lost. Like, Chicago's just lost. There's no real revolt afoot among the city electorate. You reelected, Philadelphia voters reelected Krasner, just like Cook County voters reelected Kim Fox. And this is the way they want it. It's a death cult, these big cities.
Well, yeah. And understand the rest of Pennsylvania's attitude towards Philadelphia is that Philadelphia's been a dump forever. So why should we be concerned about what goes on down there?
Right.
And if Philadelphians can't become concerned about what's happening in their city,
why should we?
Then so what? So that's really how that's going to play out in the governor's election.
How important do you think that recall election of Chesa Boudin in San Francisco next week is? I mean, if he is recalled by San Francisco area voters, for goodness sake, does that provide any hope that there may be at least a revolt afoot among some of these Soros-backed non-prosecuting prosecutors around the country?
Well, yeah, frankly, I'll be surprised if the recall succeeds. I mean, the people in San Francisco have seemed to be quite happy to go down this road, and I understand that the situation out there is every bit as bad as what we have going on in Philadelphia. But recall elections are tough to win. And, you know, with a guy like Krasner, for example, when it comes to that kind of election, I don't know how things work in California, but in Philadelphia, the ward leaders are critical to how elections turn out in Philadelphia. And the ward leaders don't care about a person's politics. All they want is money. So if you can give a ward leader $100, he's in your pocket, and that's what drives elections in Philadelphia. I would assume money, the kind of big money that Krasner has, and I'm assuming that Chesa Boudin has, that's going to be a major factor in how that election turns out and how any election in Philadelphia, for example, is going to turn out. Soros has correctly identified the choke point in the criminal justice system, and it's the local DAs, and if you can flood the zone with enough money, you can be DA for life, and I think that it's going to be tough to get rid of Boudin, but I'm certainly hopeful they'll get rid of him.
George Perry, former federal and state prosecutor, regular contributor to the American Spectator, and he blogs at knowledgeisgood.net. George, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, nice talking with you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.